Welcome to Brain in a Vat. Today we have John Martin Fisher with us, and he's going to be talking about immortality. John's going to be presenting some arguments from his latest book on the topic called Should You Choose to Live Forever? John, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
Imagine a library with a large number of books, though of course a finite number of books. And imagine that you can read all of them over time, and then you could reread them as many times as you'd like. Many people think that eventually you would get bored. They would not anymore be of interest to you. And some people have made the analogy between the large, finite library of books and living forever. And they've claimed that just as you would become bored with the books, you would become bored with living forever. So my question is this correct? Is this a valid analogy, or can we make a distinction between the library and living forever?
So I take it, John, that your view is that it's not a good analogy, and that even if you get bored in the library, you wouldn't get bored in an infinite, or not an infinite, but a very long finite life. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. It's an interesting analogy, but not a good one in the end, for a number of reasons. First of all, we come back to books, even books we've already read, with a new perspective. We're older, we have more experiences, perhaps we've grown and matured, and so we get something different out of the books every time we go back to them. It's kind of like travel. You can travel to a great city or a beautiful national park, and it's not as though we think, well, we should never go back again because we've seen it, been there, done that. We get something new every time. We look from a different perspective. We've got a different viewpoint on the world, and that's the first point about the library. Secondly, we're always adding books. In life, let's say we're doing the analogy, analogous thing. We're adding books. So it's not as though life is like a finite collection of books. And so both of these differences, in my view, make the library a bad analogy.
But then it sounds like it's not a terrible analogy. It's just that we should rethink how we'd feel in the library case. So in the library case,
yes,
we actually wouldn't have a problem spending time in an extremely large library for a very long period of time.
Yes, I think that's right. That's the first point. The second point is life would involve new experiences, new projects, which is analogous to a library that's continually acquiring new books. So, right. It's an interesting analogy because it points to important facts about what we care about in life and why living forever under certain circumstances might not be a bad thing.
So the idea is that, if I understand correctly, there would still be novelty in this limited but very large library and this limited but very long life. There would still be novelty both because new experiences do come about, but also because we approach experiences from a fresh perspective.
Right.
But even so, isn't there a fatigue that people feel? So maybe you've had enough of libraries eventually, if you spend a long time in the library. And in this case, maybe you've just had enough of living. This, by the way, is my father's view on immortality. He says, I would just get very tired.
Right. Well, you have to be careful. First, you don't want to go to the library every day, morning, noon, and night. That would become exhausting, and you would quickly lose your interest in libraries and books. So that's what I call the scrunching problem. You don't want to scrunch up your experiences in that way. We need to rotate our activities. Kierkegaard talked about a farmer who has to rotate her crops in order to avoid depleting the soil of the nutrients. And we have to do something like that with our pleasurable activities and our projects. Secondly, I think that, right, if we don't scrunch up our visits to the library, I don't see why it would necessarily be the case that we would get tired of books and libraries. We don't get tired. I never get tired of visiting San Francisco. It's an area in which I grew up. It's a wonderful, beautiful city. You can watch the fog coming in over the Golden Gate Bridge into Golden Gate Park, and there are wonderful restaurants. It's just a magnificent city. Now, it does have some social problems these days, but basically it's a marvelous city. And every time I go back, I get something new. I have new experiences. Even if I go back to the same places within the city, I'm coming back at a different age. It's been a while since I've done it. I don't see why the library would be any different. And so the idea that we would inevitably become tired doesn't resonate with me. Now, one more thing about your dad's view. I think as we grow older, and I am growing older, like all of us, one's body starts telling one that one is getting older, and eventually the body starts becoming less mobile and more painful. And as we age in our current situation, it becomes more and more difficult to pursue the projects we want and to enjoy a pain-free life. And I can certainly imagine why that would become exhausting. And you could say, I've had enough of this life, the pain, the suffering, I just can't do what I want. Granted, but that's not the kind of thought experiment I have in mind.
So in your thought experiment, when you rock up to the library every day, you're rocking up the same. It's almost like a reset. Your physical body is the same. You arrive at the library, you've got the same mental acuity, the same physical abilities, and you can sit all day and read books at the library. I'm assuming in your thought experiment about living forever, you don't age then as you live forever. You stay in a youthful point of your life. Is that how the thought experiment would function?
Right, and this is similar to the famous thought experiment that comes from the play by Carol Chapek about Alina Macropoulos. The Macropoulos case is called, made into an opera subsequently by Leos Janacek. It's about a woman who does have an elixir of eternal life, although basically it just guarantees her 300 more years. And then if she takes it again, 300 more. And it, of course, she's chronologically aging, but she's not biologically aging. Her body's not deteriorating, and she's not subject to certain fatal disease or any fatal disease. And her brain is still working well. And so she's not, well, just to reiterate, she's not biologically aging. And I imagine that we can conceive of living forever under relatively favorable circumstances in which our bodies remain vital unless we abuse them in certain ways, and then we have to take the consequences. It's not as though we can do whatever we want with impunity. But as long as we live with an eye to health and without taking excessive risks, then our bodies will remain vital and strong and healthy. Our brains will still be functioning. And so I could imagine finding that kind of immortality very attractive.
So I'm curious how the equation would change at various points in life if you were to take the elixir at that point and it were to freeze your age and your physical health at that step of your life. So if you took the elixir as a child, would it be a good thing? If you took the elixir at 20, at 30, at 40, at 90, at what point would you say it's not the right choice? Is there a band in the middle?
Good question. And it brings out the fact that much of the philosophical discussion subsequent to Bernard Williams' famous discussion of the Macropoulos case has been vague and very abstract, vague about this issue. For instance, right, does it apply to freezing one's biological state or at any age, when one's a child, when one's in one's 90s. In the case in the opera, Alina, and the play, Alina was 33 years old. And at that age, presumably one's still vital and healthy and strong and mobile, and one's brain hasn't deteriorated slightly the way mine has. That was the thought experiment that Bernard Williams had in mind. But interestingly, if you ask yourself, would I choose that elixir? Are you asking about you at your current age and your current biological circumstances? Or are you imagining that you could somehow go back to when you were 33 or 37 or 42 or 21 for that matter? That just is unclear. That's not spelled out explicitly by Bernard Williams. And also not spelled out is whether you would keep your current physical challenges. So for instance, if you have a chronic disease, such as diabetes, for instance, type 2 diabetes, are we imagining that you're choosing to live for 300 more years, or forever for that matter, with that condition? Or are we imagining that all your chronic health challenges and diseases and disorders go away? Now, that again is also unclear. I think for the purposes of fixing ideas and making our question clear and interesting, we can imagine that we're thinking about life under favorable conditions in which the chronic health challenges one has continue, but that they can be controlled, as we can control type 2 diabetes, and that you can still live a full life and satisfying life, although it may not be perfect. Human life is not perfect, and we operate under constraints. Now, if you happen to have conditions that are extremely painful and impair you either physically or mentally to the point where you can't really live a rewarding life, then the answer is clear. You wouldn't choose the elixir. But I think in order to make this a really clear choice or a clear question, we have to imagine that you, as you currently are, with whatever chronic health problems you have, will be biologically frozen in time, even though you chronologically age. I further imagine that the environment is relatively clean, that you have enough food and you have adequate shelter, you have adequate medical care, because you'll still get sick, you'll still become injured. We're trying to imagine a life that's as similar to ours as possible, except for it lasts much longer. So that's what I'm imagining. And then it becomes clear that it's a fallacy to extrapolate from our current situation in which elderly people do become increasingly frail and, if I may use the word, decrepit or impaired, both mentally and physically. We can't really extrapolate from that to the conditions of the thought experiment.
I think that's what a lot of people have in mind when they say they don't want to live forever, is they witness aging in their parents or grandparents and say, I don't want to be in that state indefinitely. That would be horrific. And so I wouldn't want to live forever. And so I think it's very important to spell that out, to say that it would be in a relatively healthy state, a relatively happy state, right, and a relatively happy environment. What is interesting, though, is that even though it seems very obvious that there are problems with aging, associated with aging, there's suffering that comes along with it, there also does seem in a lot of people's view to be something valuable in it, in gaining wrinkles on your face, in feeling different from how you did in your youth, both within your body and compared with other youthful bodies, that maybe there's some dignity in that. And the person who lives forever in a youthful state loses that dignity.
Very interesting question. I would try and articulate it a little or distinguish different aspects. First of all, yes, you know, older people often are happier. I think the empirical data show that. I mean, maybe paradoxically, maybe that's not what you would expect antecedently to doing the studies, but yes, older people tend to be happier. Now that I'm an older person, I myself have experienced that. Part of it is you're more mature, you know how to put things in perspective, you don't get too panicked about what might be called little things. You've established who you are. You've figured out your identity by and large, although you're still evolving. You don't have to prove yourself. Maybe you already have a family, loved ones who surround you. Maybe you've already accomplished what you want in a career. So there's more a chance to be happy. That doesn't mean it's perfect, because there are all sorts of challenges at all points in life. Now, about the wrinkles, right, there's a kind of ambivalence in the human population. Maybe I see it, especially in California, people engage in anti-aging practices, and they go to anti-aging medicine, and they use Botox, they use all sorts of lotions and strategies for and surgeries, strategies for looking younger. Again, I would distinguish that from the idea that there is a certain dignity and happiness and satisfaction that mentally and psychologically comes with older age. The appearance stuff is not something that appeals to me in particular, but many people do aspire to the fountain of youth in the sense of a youthful appearance. I see it all around me. I'm neutral about that. And I certainly think you can overdo plastic surgery to the point where it defeats one's purpose.
So let's push this further away from the issue of physical appearance to the issue of physical feeling in the body. So at least my experience as I've grown older, and I'm not as far along that experience as you are, but I am further along than I was. I'm 39 now, is that I have a lot less energy than when I was 29 or 19. Mm-hmm. And so I have to select my experiences a little bit more carefully. And maybe with that comes a whole new way of valuing experiences a new cognitive operation that I'm forced to perform. I'm forced to choose what I want to do with my day in a way that maybe I never had to do 10 or 20 years ago. And let's say we were to freeze me at 25, I would never have had that experience. Isn't that a loss?
Interesting question. It might be a loss, but you have to put that on the scales along with the gains. I think it's always a complicated question about choosing to live forever or choosing to live for a long time at different ages, and the challenges will be different. So even if I were asked, if I wanted to take the elixir now, given my current health, and I have some of those chronic ailments and my current biological status, yes, I would definitely take it, because I still find my life very rewarding and my body supports it to a large extent. I think a 19-year-old or a 24-year-old or a 29-year-old might well have a positive attitude toward it, but it depends on their particular status. Remember, though, it's philosophically not that interesting to ask the question whether you would choose to live much longer if you were in terrible pain, or you were impaired, or you were in horrible poverty, or your environment was dirty and ugly. Those are not that interesting philosophical questions. But what we're imagining is relatively favorable circumstances. Now, there are pluses and minuses, pros and cons, and there will be losses. And one loss in choosing, let's say, to live forever at 25 biologically, and psychologically you would still grow, but biologically at 25 is you wouldn't have the experience of lessening energy and lessening physical prowess. Now, it may be that there will be better anti-aging medications and caffeine that can help you, but analogs to caffeine. But yes, you will lose something. Also, apart from the physical prowess and energy that you lose some of the fraughtness of life, where we have to make selections and choices, where we can't choose everything, or we don't have the opportunity to come back an indefinite number of times and make different choices and kind of experiment or subtract the bad ones. So there'll be costs, but then again, I would suggest that the gains might well outweigh the losses.
So one of our prior guests, David Benatar, he says it's better not have been born because he thinks that life, he has these sophisticated arguments for this view, but basically it comes down to the idea that life is full of bad things. And if you live longer, then you just have more of those bad things. So when you say there's benefits to living forever, what are those benefits? Is it pleasure? Why would we want to live longer?
Right. I think we have to first figure out what's valuable and what we care about, what's rewarding in our mortal lives as we live them, not as we lead them. And some of what we value are pleasurable experiences, sensual, pleasurable experiences, eating delicious food, listening to beautiful music. It doesn't have to be great classical music. Whatever we find compelling and musically beautiful, hiking on a fall day where you see the bright sun and the beautiful foliage, colorful foliage, sex, healthy, good sex, all the things that we find pleasurable, that's part of what we value and find rewarding about life. But it's not all we value. We also value engaging in projects that, pursuing social justice, trying to understand the great philosophers, or writing a novel or poetry, or conditioning and working out to try and run a marathon. In my case, that would be impossible, but run a mile in a better time. We have projects, and they needn't all be active, although most of us think that active projects give more meaningfulness to our life. But it's not as though they're necessary for a meaningful life. Maybe you just like to sit and watch a streaming television show or films, or maybe you just like to follow a sports team. Those are relatively passive, though not entirely passive. These are things we value, most of us, and individuals will differ, of course. And the crucial point is, when we live longer, we have more opportunities to have those things, to pursue those pleasures and those projects. More is better in this context. And so that's what I would say. Well, it's a great question, because in this literature, in the debates about the potential desirability or undesirability of living forever, the dialectic usually it focuses on the objections to it, the negative side. And then those of us who take the more optimistic side try and defeat the negative side. But we don't focus so much about what's good about immortality, what we want. And maybe that's because people think it's obvious. But what I think we need to see is more of what we care about is valuable, and we have a greater chance of having more in an immortal life than a mortal life.
So one of the objections one might give to that line of reasoning is maybe the correct analogy to living forever and having more time to pursue the projects that you would normally pursue during a limited lifespan or a much smaller lifespan, it would maybe be similar to being on an infinite holiday. And what some people experience on infinite holidays is that the projects that they had, which they pursued with great gusto and fervor on weekends and in their spare time, they all of a sudden have a long stretch of time to pursue and fall instead into a melancholy. So they fall instead into a depression where they actually get nothing done. They become a couch potato. They feel frustrated with themselves. They feel a lack of agency because there's so much time available. And they realize, goodness, I need structure in my life. I need to get to work. And perhaps the notion that your life is going to end is providing a structure. Without that, it's similar to an infinite holiday and the person on it feeling aimless.
People often experience similar things. Great philosophers have argued that death gives meaning to life. It makes life fraught and precious. And without that, we have perhaps even no motivation to get off the couch. I have heard people who say they retired much too early because in retirement they have lots of time. And they always thought, gosh, if I only weren't spending so much time at work, I could pursue my hobbies, I could listen to music, I could do, I could write, I could read novels. Then when they retire, they don't have anything that propels them, that galvanizes them. And that can be depressing, right? And the same with a sabbatical. I know many of academics who say, gosh, I'm on sabbatical, I have all this time, but it's hard for me to get to work. So too much time can be a problem, especially in our finite lives or our mortal lives where we're used to deadlines and pressure, time pressure. I don't think it has to be that way, though. I think that, again, we don't want to scrunch up our activities. We want to spread them out in a sensible way. We want to engage in pleasurable activities, physical activities, athletic activities, but also more cerebral projects and hobbies, chess, maybe reading. I have a friend who reads mathematics, though that's not something I really love, but he loves reading through books on abstract algebra and logic. And I certainly know people who love theoretical physics, astronomy, and philosophy. And so I think if one distributed those activities in a sensible way, like Kierkegaard talked about rotating your crops, I think it needn't turn out that you will become kind of listless and won't know what to do, or will lose interest in your hobbies. I mean, why exactly would you lose interest in your hobbies? I think, you know, there are philosophers. Shelley Kagan, the American philosopher at Yale, has written about the fact that he loves Thai food, but eventually he would just get tired of it, maybe even sick of it, but he would be bored by Thai food. It wouldn't interest him anymore. There's another very well-known American philosopher at University of Massachusetts, Philip Bricker, who has said exactly the opposite. He also loves Thai food, and he can't imagine getting tired of it. Now, of course, morning, noon, night, afternoon snack, if you had Thai food, yes, very quickly you get tired of it, but you don't have to scrunch it up that way. And Philip Bricker is amusing in that he thinks he doesn't want a, quote, piddling alpha null number of years, which is the lowest level of infinity. He wants a higher infinity in order to keep eating the Thai food and keep doing the other things he loves. So part of it might just be personality and your own predilections and maybe how imaginative you are. But I just don't see how, why engaging in fun projects that are fun and compelling in our current lives would necessarily lose their appeal. Maybe for some people, but not for all.
It's interesting you mentioned Thai food, because I spend quite a few months a year in Thailand every year, and I love the food. And I do experience this attenuation of joy by the end of the trip, eating the food. And then I leave Thailand and I massively miss it. And I think maybe that's the point, is that, yes, you might get a little bit bored, but when you realize that life's going to end, you definitely want more of that, even if it's boring. Right. And I mean, I found it interesting earlier that you said that at your age, you would take the elixir. And I think it's interesting that almost at every step of people's lives, even people who are suffering immensely, do try to prolong their lives. They take medication that gives them a few more years.
People with cancers that are terminal and involve considerable pain or limitations sometimes or often choose drugs that have terrible side effects, but they may only give them a couple extra months, but they prefer that. The way I put it, if you are religious, then you have hope at least of a good afterlife. But on a secular view where you assume no afterlife, you might say living for a couple more months in pain is better, because it's better than nothing. Something's better than nothing. Even if it's not great, or even if it involves considerable pain and suffering, it's better than nothing. But I think the main point about Thailand is that when you're there, that's all you can have. Or, I mean, I'm sure there are other options, but if you're eating Thai food for 3 or 4 months, you're not rotating your crops, basically. You're not rotating your pleasures. And that is very important. Think about your favorite popular song, or even great classical piece. I think it wrecks the pleasure if you listen to it too much, scrunched up. It just wrecks it. And but if I go back to a piece of music I love, let's say Bach's second unaccompanied violin partita, which I think is wonderful, I assume that if I listened to it every day, it would lose some of its delight or its appeal. But I go back to it, maybe sometimes 6 months passes, maybe a couple months, and it always has that tremendous quality that engages me and delights me and produces awe. And so I think a lot of the key here is to distribute your activities appropriately.
So far, everything we've discussed has had to do with whether it's rational for a particular agent to choose whether to live forever. There's two related questions, though, that might have different answers. So the one question is it possible for the very same person to persist forever, where that person is made up in a similar way to the way we're made up? And I'm not asking an empirical question. It's, you know, over time, a mind forgets things. So I'm 39 and I don't remember a whole lot of what happened when I was 4 years old. I imagine if I was 950 years old, I wouldn't remember a whole lot of what happened now. Would I even be the same agent persisting through time, is one question. And then after that, I'd like to get onto the question of what should we as a society want to do? Should we all want to live forever? But let's first discuss this metaphysical personhood question.
Right. It does depend on your views of personhood, personal identity, and the related question of persistence over time. And my co-author in the book, Should You Choose to Live Forever, Stephen Cave, is an animalist about personal identity. He thinks I am essentially a particular animal, and that animal couldn't, within reason, almost certainly couldn't persist 950 years or forever. I take a different view. I believe in some sort of experiential or phenomenological theory of personal identity. And important to that is a continuity of memory and value and intention. That's what makes me who I am over time. Now, how do I answer the question that you asked? When I'm 950, or where, when an individual is 950, that individual will not have presumably any memories of what we're talking about today or this particular interview, no matter how compelling it is. And it's always fun to talk to you, Mark. It's always fun to talk to you, Jason, and also to Mark. I think this is my fifth opportunity, and it's always great. But I will, if I am fortunate enough to live forever or even till 950, I won't remember it. But the key is, even in my mortal life, I don't remember anything that happened to me when I was 4 years old or even or five. I have seen pictures of me bundled up in the snow in Cleveland, Ohio, when I was three or four. My parents tell me that we moved to San Francisco when I was five. I have no memories of those times, and yet it was me. That little boy was the same individual as I am now, perhaps at a different stage. Certainly, I look different and I have different characteristics and features, but it was the same particular metaphysical individual. And that's because there's a certain continuity of mental states. When I was six, I remembered a lot of what happened when I was five. And when I was seven, a lot of what happened when I was six and five. And the, as it were, adjacent times are connected, or my mental states, including my memories, but perhaps not limited to them, my values, my intentions, they relate in a certain distinctive way to what just preceded. And as long as those proximal, you might say, connections are in place, the distal, the facts about the distal times, when I'm 71 as opposed to 5 or 12, I think, let me start that over. What I believe is my mental states have to be connected like links in a chain. Each link is connected in a certain way to the previous link and to the subsequent link. Now, the link at one end of the chain is not directly connected to the link at the beginning or near the beginning. But as they are parts of the same chain, and that's because the adjacent or contiguous links are connected in the right way. I'd say the same thing about our mental states. So even if you're a memory theorist or an experiential theorist like I am, it doesn't follow that I can't be the same individual, even if I have very different mental states in the future.
Okay, so now we can have agents that persist through time. There's good reason for a particular agent to choose to live forever. Something that Stephen Cave says is, even if that were the case, it would be disastrous for society as a whole if everyone was offered that choice. And he looks at a number of different outcomes. So one of them is widening inequality in society. Maybe not everyone would be given the choice. Maybe only the ultra wealthy would be given the choice. We might have overpopulation, or we might have underpopulation. Basically, he thinks that the world would be a worse place if we were all given this choice. What are your thoughts on that?
Stephen develops these worries in a very insightful way, in a very powerful way, and I agree with many of them. I should say that my primary focus has been the somewhat narrower philosophical question as to whether there's something intrinsic to human nature, to the fact that we have characters and personalities. Is there something about that that makes it the case that it's necessarily not worthy of choice to live forever, that immortality has to be unattractive or undesirable simply because we're human beings the way we are, with characters. So that's what I focused on. I do not believe that it would be necessarily undesirable. So I am not a curmudgeon about immortality. But now, moving on to the more practical and very important questions about how it would work out in the world, I'm much less sanguine. I would not call myself an optimist. I would call myself a realist. And as such, I do not believe even, I don't know if Stephen would go so far, but I would say it's not probable or likely that we will be able to maintain the social and environmental context within which we could live under very under favorable circumstances. In other words, I don't think, especially in the along the trajectory we're currently on, it looks like the environment either has passed the tipping point or soon will, after which we won't be able to live good lives in a clean environment. So I'm very concerned about that. I'm not despairing. I'm not an immortality alarmist, but I am very concerned. And so those are all important, difficult issues. I still think one can, an important and interesting question, one that's dominated the philosophical discussion, is just, would it be essentially boring, or would I lose all motivation? Would life lose its meaningfulness? Those are the questions I've mainly been interested in. But these others are important questions, and Stephen explores them with considerable sophistication. I think there are answers to some of the questions, but they are not all, they come with their pros and cons too. So one possibility is that I live forever, but I'm the sole immortal. That has problems because my friends will be dying. If I have children, they'll be dying. And that can be quite depressing. So we might imagine a group of immortals, but not everyone. Enough fellow immortals that I can have families, I can get married, I can have friends. Perhaps my children will be immortal and my grandchildren, but it's limited so that there aren't explosions in populations like if everyone were immortal. That's the kind of model that I think is most defensible, although it introduces an inequality that might be quite objectionable and that it might exacerbate already existing inequalities. So there are justice problems with that limited conception of the population of immortal people. If we imagine that everyone has the opportunity to be immortal, then we would have to imagine no children. And I know this is something Stephen Cave finds objectionable and problematic, but it is something that many of the immortality optimists have chosen as the only viable way to imagine it in the world, working out in the world. And Aubrey de Grey, the famous proponent of living forever, has suggested that that would be the only way that it would work if people stopped having children. Problems of enforcement. So in sum, if it's just me, I'll be a lone and lonely immortal. If it's just a small group, I won't be so lonely, but then there are social justice problems, maybe not sustainable then. If it's everyone, then we would have to limit children actually to zero, and then that's got implementation problems. And it also has the problem that many people find having children and raising families part of one of the most rewarding parts of life. What do I think about all this? It doesn't touch anything pertinent to whether human beings, by their very nature, would find immortality not worthy of choice. That's just a separate question. It's more applied question. I would think that, like I said, there are pros and cons to every choice. And despite the fact that it would require everyone, no one being able to have children and figuring out a decent way to implement that, despite that, there would be so many advantages that I would prefer that. A situation in which everyone at least has the opportunity to live forever under favorable circumstances. That's assuming all these environmental problems are solved, but if everyone has that opportunity and children are not allowed, that's better. That's better than mortality. Why? Because we can have more of what we care about in an immortal life, and that's a huge, huge boon.
So just out of interest, why no children? Is it because then you would just have more proliferation? They would become immortal. They'd have children. They'd become immortal, and yes. You'd have overpopulation. Is that the reason? Yeah,
that's the worry. Now, if there are no children, you know, one thing we have not discussed or addressed in our conversation is what exactly we mean by forever. And in our book, Stephen Cave and I fix on a particular conception, which Stephen has called medical immortality rather than true immortality in previous work, and I followed him. In this book, we use the term radical life extension. So that's what we're talking about. Would you choose radical life extension? And roughly, that's the idea that you wouldn't be biologically deteriorating and you wouldn't die of natural causes. You could still be killed. You could still be murdered, run over by a truck, fall off a cliff. I won't go through any more of the depressing list. But so on average, maybe it's been guesstimated at about 6,000 years. Let's say 6 to 10,000 years, radical life extension. Under radical life extension, we would, let's say, be living on average 8,000 years. If we had children and they were radically life extended, and they had children who were similarly life extended, there would be a population explosion that would put pressure on resources. Now, I should point out that over time, if we are not truly immortal, but just radically life extended, it means that we're vulnerable to being murdered or dying, run over by a semi-truck, though not a disease. That means over time, some people will be, in fact, dying. And after a certain number of years, there may be enough people who have died that we will want to allow a subpopulation to have children. And maybe we'd have to do some kind of lottery to determine that. But overall, I agree with Stephen that there are significant environmental challenges as we are now, of course, but they would be made much worse if people were immortal and allowed to have immortal children.
Just one last question. Would your answer in the individual case, barring the social issues, would your answer in the individual case be different if the question was, should you want to live with radical life extension versus should you choose to be truly immortal? Would those have different answers?
Wait, first of all, I should say the literature in contemporary philosophy, much of which follows Bernard Williams' very seminal article on the Macropolis case, in which he did argue that a choice for the elixir would necessarily be the wrong one, would be irrational. Almost all the literature has not clearly distinguished between true immortality, where you're literally living an infinite number of years and invulnerable to death. They haven't distinguished that concept from radical life extension. Now, radical life extension is still a very, very long time. Think of it as, you know, 8,000 years after the historical Jesus. That is a very, very long time. And many of the same arguments that people invoke the curmudgeons invoke to show that we wouldn't want to be truly immortal also would apply to radical life extension, though some of them I think are different. The reason I would not choose true immortality, but would choose radical life extension under favorable circumstances at my age and my level of health, which isn't perfect, but not too bad, is that if you're truly immortal, you're invulnerable to death. And it implies that you couldn't kill yourself or arrange for physician-assisted suicide. And to choose that is to choose something extremely risky. Because what if the curmudgeons are correct? I don't think they are, but what if they are correct and I would fall into depression, anemia, alienation, or otherwise live a totally unrewarding life? I don't want to take the chance that that would last for billions and billions of years. And that's why, and if you imagine that I'm invulnerable to death by any other means, I couldn't die if I fell off a cliff or a semi-truck ran over me or I was murdered by, a jealous individual, it follows, presumably, that I couldn't arrange for my own death or kill myself. How could that not be? So that's very risky. But radical life extension is consistent with arrangements that would give me an exit strategy. So that's why I think there's a difference.